This week on Barbell Shrugged, we talk to Ben Greenfield and learn how to use cutting-edge techniques to transform your body, achieve your physical goals, and become superhuman.
Hey, this is Rich Froning. You're listening to Barbell Shrugged. For the video version, go to barbellshrugged.com.
Welcome to Barbell Shrugged. I'm Mike Bletso here with Doug Larson. We're down at Paleo FX in Austin, Texas. Big convention of experts that specialize in nutrition, training, and all sorts of other things. We're standing here with Ben Greenfield. You're a former bodybuilder, now endurance athlete. You've written some books. You've got a fantastic blog and a podcast. So I think we'll be talking about your book a little bit today.
Yeah, man, for sure.
You signed it for Doug. I feel so special. Yeah, he was like, oh my God, Mike. He came up running. He actually skipped up to me, big smile, said, Ben, sign this for me.
It's a very neat signature. It's
very scribbly.
It's not sloppy at all.
No.
Yeah.
Very legible.
It's pretty close to my actual handwriting. I've got chicken scratch.
Proof. He signed it.
That's what happens when you write with a keyboard 90% of the time.
Oh, yeah. Dude, if I start writing with a pen or a pencil, like by the time I get to my last name on a form, my hand starts cramping.
I forgot cursive so long ago.
Can you give us a little bit of a history, your athletic history?
Yeah.
Any history at all, your education, whatever you want to tell us about.
Well, I was a collegiate tennis player and then got into bodybuilding after that. And, you know, I've always been a sports nut. So I played middle for the men's volleyball team, played a whole set for the water polo team. And
water polo, nasty sport.
Yeah, rocks, though.
Yeah.
It's fun. And then I got into triathlon. You know, I was an exercise science major in college and got a master's degree in exercise physiology and human biomechanics. And, you know, just because of that, you're constantly surrounded by sports and exercise. And so, you know, I've been at it for a long time. And once I graduated, opened a bunch of personal training gyms and studios and started getting into Ironman triathlon, pretty hardcore. I raced Hawaii Ironman World Championships 5 times and did 5 other Ironmans and 75 other triathlons around the world. And you know, now I'm kind of getting into obstacle racing. But about 6 years ago when my kids were born, I sold all my gym equipment, all my studios, and now I do I speak. I do online consulting. I write books like that one we have there and blog and podcast.
How many books you have?
14. So
what? Holy shit.
I was thinking you're gonna say
big
like
ones like
three.
That. It's like a 600 page book.
They're not all as big as that. And a lot of my products are like they're like online products where you'll buy like say like a triathlon training product and it's a collection of audios and videos and a training plan.
Mm-hmm.
Or I've got like a what's called the Superhuman package, which is, you know, 14 CDs that are just, you know, performance and digestion and fat loss and stuff like that. So some of the stuff aren't traditional, you know, books, but
right. Yeah. Something that doesn't take you as long as that took to make.
Yeah, that's a chore. Big traditional printed books are tough. You know, like they say, one of the unhealthiest things you can do is write a book on health, right?
I didn't know they said that, but yeah.
I've heard that a lot of times from authors in the health industry who go on book tour and spend their life on an airplane after they publish a book.
The promoting of the book.
Oh, dude.
Maybe not the writing of the book is so bad for your health.
A lot of people are writing, too. A lot of people get a deadline. They just, you know, they freak out once that thing gets set in stone, and it becomes very stressful. So,
yeah. Were you a guy, if you had a year to write a book or 6 months to write a book, you wait until 2 months left and then you just crush the whole thing? Or are you pretty good about chipping away?
I am a complete 2 shitty pages a day kind of guy. Mm-hmm. So that's it.
When do the good pages happen?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the idea with that philosophy is the pages eventually become better and you go back. Like I'll publish a blog post, for example. And I think a lot of times my audience doesn't know this, but I'll go back 5 times and revise it. Like after I publish it and add research or fix typos. But, you know,
I've heard that before. You don't write a good book. You rewrite a good book.
Yeah. Seth Godin's one of my favorite motivational authors. And he's just like, ship your product. Once it's ready, ship it. And it's never going to be perfect, but, you know, get the thing out there and then, you know, fix it as you go.
Yeah, that probably holds put out a 2.0 later.
Yeah, that holds a lot of people back. Especially, well, you know, if you do ebooks or something, that makes it even easier.
Yeah, and it depends too on your product. If you're selling hip implants, you probably wouldn't want to do that.
It'll be
fine. Just get it out there. We don't need to test that any further.
Right.
That's good.
So I was flipping through your book, and the preface of the book, you ask a question, is exercise unhealthy? And I haven't read it yet, so what's that all about?
Well, we have so many people out there who are, you know, everything from weekend warriors to CrossFitters to Spartan racers to triathletes and marathoners, and the prevailing thought in fitness is still that exercise is healthy, when in fact, you know, one of the things that I do is I look at the blood work and the biomarkers of athletes every single week. So I work as a consultant for a company called Wellness FX. Mm-hmm. And so what I look at are things like HSCRP, inflammatory markers, testosterone, cortisol, sex hormone binding globulin, thyroid stimulating hormone, white blood cell count and immune system strength, you know, hemoglobin, iron, ferritin. There's all these parameters that are more out of whack in the athletic community than many times in the general population. Mm-hmm. So it's like athletes, they don't have to deal with cardiometabolic risk factors in many cases, like, you know, whatever, like super duper high body fat or insulin insensitivity from really surging blood glucose values. But there are a ton of hormonal and inflammatory parameters that truly make exercise unhealthy for many people. And there are a lot of folks, you know, especially in our community, people who are maybe kind of pushing things to the next level.
You're talking about maybe athletes that are pushing their performance.
Yeah, not just that. I mean, pretty much like people who are above and beyond Zumba, you know, like there are folks who aren't interested in CrossFit or triathlon or anything like that at all, who just go to the gym for an hour a day and they do stuff wrong. You know, they don't incorporate a lot of the recovery biohacks and, you know, nutrition and supplement type of things I talk about in the book, and they really are probably doing themselves less of a favor with exercise compared to them maybe using a standing workstation all day long. So by the way, I love that we're standing while we're podcasting right now.
That's, oh, cool.
That's,
yeah.
That's what I do at home.
And if I sit for longer than like an hour, it adds 10 minutes to my warm up when I got to go work out.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's related to this whole concept I talk about in the book about how to fix this issue, is really approaching things from an ancestral standpoint, right? You try and tweak your work environment and your play environment and your home environment so that you are in hunter-gatherer mode all day, whether it's like the pull-up bar installed in the door of your office or something heavy you can go out to your garage or your backyard and lift a few times a day, the standing workstation or the moving workstation. And then exercise is just the icing on the cake.
Right? Yeah, sounds like you're a big fan of like keeping your activity level up throughout the day.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Not like high volume stuff. It's not like you got to go out and push, you know, a 10K run or anything like that. You're talking about just doing really simple to elevate your heart rate a little bit.
Exactly. So like when I do Ironman, you know, I'll do Ironman between 9 and 10 hours, but I only train 8 to 10 hours a week. And most of my peers are out there for 20 to 30 hours a week because they have this approach that you exercise, you beat yourself up with exercise, you don't recover properly, you eat nutrient dense or nutrient undense foods. I'm going to make up that word right on the spot.
There you go. Calorie dense foods.
Foods that are poor in nutrient density. Mm-hmm. And then you continue to just beat up your body with exercise without pulling out a lot of these things, you know, that I talk about in the book, you know, everything from cold thermogenesis to curcumin. I mean, there's so many different things that you can do to enhance recovery or to tweak your environment to exercise less. Mm-hmm. And it's just a matter of kind of systematizing it and learning it. And, you know, what I want to do is create kind of a cookbook for folks to be able to do that.
So what do you think is one of the most common mistakes people are making when they're approaching exercise that are kind of putting them in a dangerous zone when they exercise?
Probably two of the biggest things are fascia and nervous system. So from a fascial standpoint, I mean, I'm sure you guys have probably talked about it before on your show, just the issue with cross-linking and fascial adhesions, and so many people, you know, pulling that rope tight when it already has knots in it, you know, and that's a big, big issue, especially considering that the integrity of your fascia is pretty pretty correlative to your ability to produce neurotransmitters. And so a lot of times you can get things like depression and brain fog and inability to sleep that go hand in hand with these fascial adhesions.
So how would you fix that problem?
Well, that type of problem, I mean, it kind of depends, but you can look at everything from Graston technique to a lot of the stuff that Kelly Starrett talks about in his Becoming a Supple Leopard book. I mean, the way that I do it is I have a rumble roller and I hit it on Tuesdays and Fridays for about 20 minutes. And then it's usually a pretty comprehensive deep tissue massage about once a month, around 60 to 90 minutes. And, you know, but I stay on top of that. That's a system every single week. I keep a golf ball underneath my desk. And so when I'm standing around working, I'll roll that thing underneath one foot and transfer it to the other foot. So there's some element of deep tissue work each week. And then from a nervous system standpoint, tracking sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system integrity is super duper important. And in the age of heart rate variability and the ability to track that very, very easily via a wide variety of apps and sensors.
I heard about HRV for the first time maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. And then now it seems like everybody's talking about it, not just fitness, but like people who want to be more productive and as a maybe a business executive or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Everybody's talking about it, but you know, so here's the deal. I mean, you have to quantify if you're going to use it, and you have to get to know your nervous system. So I have some athletes who, if we test, say, heart rate variability, and we look at sympathetic nervous system strength, which is
versus parasympathetic for folks at home?
Yeah, you've got your sympathetic fight or flight based nervous system and your parasympathetic rest or digest based nervous system. Both those elements of the nervous system feed into your heart's electrical pathway via something called your vagus nerve. And so what that means is if you measure the amount of time between each heartbeat, you can actually see how well both the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system are feeding into your cardiovascular function. So it's a really, really cool way to be able to quantify. It's one of the most important markers that you can take, and one of the most convenient ones you can take compared to doing like a blood testosterone, you know, evaluation every morning.
This would quantify the stress level in your life.
So this would quantify stress from aerobic overtraining. It would quantify stress from anaerobic overtraining, but it would depend on what you look at. And that's what I don't like, honestly, about some of these heart rate variability apps or tools is they'll just say,
anyone you want to call out?
No,
I'm just kidding.
No, and a lot of them have the ability to be able to give more information. People just don't really know how to delve into that aspect of the app.
Probably some training involved there.
Yeah, like I use one called a Sweetbeat app, and it's kind of based off that green, yellow, red. You know, yeah, you're stressed out. Mm-hmm. You should be careful today. You're not stressed out, but I mean, if you flip one of the screens in there over and it goes into, you know, what I call geek mode, it'll show you what's called your low frequency and your high frequency score. Mm-hmm. And the high frequency score is the strength of your parasympathetic rest and digest nervous system, which if low would indicate that you've overtrained yourself aerobically. And your low frequency score would be the strength of your sympathetic nervous system, which if low would indicate that maybe you've done too much anaerobic training.
That's likely for me. Yeah. I'm never going to overtrain aerobically.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's one thing to see, okay, my heart rate variability is low, I'm stressed out. It's another thing to know, okay, here's why I'm stressed out. I ran too far. I did too much low level training.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I'm good to go. I can go for a swim or yoga or, you know, something aerobic today, but my sympathetic nervous system needs a break.
Do you think maybe in that context, if someone's a CrossFitter, could that decide whether they're going to do strength training today versus an aerobic session?
Exactly. And so this starts to come down to genetics. I mean, do you come from a more fragile genetic heritage? Maybe, you know, kind of like a gatherer farmer kind of culture. Do you come from more of a hunter warrior background in terms of your genetic heritage? And how many times can you get thrown against the wall before you crack? And so some people, say like a CrossFitter, they'll be able to go to battle every day. There are some people that can do that, and I'll look at their heart rate variability scores and their sympathetic nervous system, you know, 24 hours, boom, ready to go. And, you know, that's just the way that some folks are hardwired. And then other people can handle two, say, CrossFit sessions a week, and that's all their sympathetic nervous system can take. Mm-hmm. And everything else is, you know, fascial work, yoga, low level, you know, like fasted morning aerobic workouts, you know, easy swims, stuff like that. So, that's another really important variable in addition to, you know, paying attention to your fascial integrity is this whole nervous system component and being able to track it so you know what your body can handle, because it's not going to be the same. I mean, if you're following whatever, you know, the WADs and you're just doing what it says every day, then, you know, it's not really customized to you. So
you train any CrossFit athletes, or are you just consulting with them on this type of thing?
Most of the work that I do with CrossFitters is via blood and biomarkers. So looking at what's going on inside the body, and then...
Do you do that via Wellness FX, or is that
separate?
Well,
I do both. Some people will not go through Wellness FX, and some people will go to a wholesale lab testing company like Direct Labs, for example. where you'll get a test and they'll send you a PDF with your scores, and folks will hire me via my website to do a consult with them and go through their markers. And then other times I'll go through Wellness FX. But I'm doing a lot more one-off consulting with folks, like phone calls with people, than I am coaching. I only coach 12 athletes right now. And most of them are doing like triathlons, marathons. A couple of them are not really doing anything except just wanting to, you know, look good naked.
Just be fit.
And kinda, be fit and feel good and live a long time. So
earlier you said that you train only about 10 hours a week, and most traditional Ironman athletes train maybe two or three or four times as much as you. So how is your training different than those guys?
There's a few different components of my training. One we already talked about. I've got low level physical intensity worked in throughout the entire day, and I don't count 6 hours of standing during the day as exercise. But I am using all those tiny feet and hip and core muscles that, if I go for a run at the end of the day, allow me to run at a high intensity for 20 minutes versus going out and having to throw down, you know, 2 hours or 3 hours to get that time on the feet, so to speak. I use a lot of high intensity interval training, and I talk about this in my book, how when you look at upregulating mitochondrial biogenesis, which is the density of your mitochondria, the powerhouses of your cells that allow you to produce ATP, there's really two different ways to skin that cat. One is via high intensity interval training that's going to upregulate what's called your AMPK pathway and allow for you to produce more mitochondria via that method. The other is via what's called polarized training, which is kind of an 80-20 approach. And you see a lot of elite, like Kenyan marathoners and Tour de France cyclists and folks like this, using this approach to training, which is 80% of what you do is very low level intensity. At a heart rate that's right around 180 minus your age. So, you know, I'm 32, so I'd be going at a heart rate of around 148 for something like that, which for me, that's breathing easy. That's a conversational pace. And then 20% is all out extremely hard. And there is no gray zone, no middle zone. So if you're using that 80-20 approach and you're a pro athlete with a ton of time, that's actually a pretty good way to train. And ultimately, if you're not going to use a minimalist training approach, you can get really good results with that. I use the complete opposite approach. I use very low level physical intensity, very, very low level, just by standing workstations and things of that nature. And then I do brief spurts of high intensity interval training, typically at the end of each day. So between about 4 and 6 p.m. when central nervous system activity is peaked, when body temp is peaked, when protein synthesis post-workout will peak, when I am going to be eating more carbs, for example, with dinner anyways. So I time the workout in that window, do something very brief and intense.
So you're using HRV not just to decide whether to go hard that day or not, but also to what time of the day to train?
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
A heart rate monitor all day, every day?
Well, they've got a patch now. It's in beta testing, and I'm one of their beta testers for a company called Vital Connect that has a patch now that you can just wear during the entire day.
Yeah.
But what I'll do, or what folks can do right now, is just a Bluetooth heart rate monitor that speaks straight to an app. Now, as far as the training component goes, there was one other thing I was going to say until you totally derailed me, Mike.
That's what we do here.
Anyways, I was going somewhere, but I don't remember the last thing I was going to say.
Doug, can you remember?
There you go.
Can you save us?
I don't remember where you were going with that.
Yeah.
While we're thinking of it, what's an example of what your high intensity workouts look like specifically?
So for example, a treadmill workout for me at the end of a day of time spent on my feet would be a 10 by 30 second sprint on the treadmill, 10 miles per hour, 10% incline, stepping off the treadmill for about 60 seconds and just, you know, walking the gym in between each and then coming back. Another example would be some real brief high intensity rounds, like in my backyard, where it's like kettlebell swing to jump rope to ab rollouts to suspension trainer single leg squats, just boom, boom, boom a few times through, but typically some kind of a cardio burst, like a swing thrown into some slightly lower intensity sets to allow for recovery of the cardiovascular system and then back in. And then in the off season, both myself and a lot of the athletes I work with will use a lot more kind of super slow restorative training, where we're still getting We're still getting a lot of peripheral resistance and peripheral blood flow feeding back to the heart, so we maintain a lot of cardiovascular integrity. Mm-hmm. But it's you know, kind of like a Doug McGuff body by science type of protocol where it's super slow. Mm-hmm. You know, 5 to 6 sets, 10 seconds up, 10 seconds down. You're getting 120 to 180 seconds of time under tension, but at a very low intensity. Mm-hmm. And I'll use that a lot with folks who are either just coming to me, kind of getting back into exercise or starting into a routine, or for somebody who kind of needs a break in the off season, but for when we still want to maintain some strength. So
mm-hmm. Is that kind of more towards looking at connective tissue there, like reducing injuries and stuff like that?
Yeah, exactly. Kind of low impact, and also that type of training isn't that hard on the nervous system, really.
Right.
So for example, like if I'll put on my heart rate variability app and do a barbell squat, that when you look at heart rate variability score, lower is worse if you're looking at it from like a stress standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And a barbell squat is one of the lowest I've ever seen. You know, I compare that to a sprint and I'm still lower doing a squat in the gym. But doing this super slow, kind of focused, deep nasal breathing kind of work on, you know, like a machine, for example, that's pretty easy on the nervous system, and it allows you to get some restorative exercise in. It's also pretty good if you've got, let's say like a CrossFitter who wants to get multiple resistance training sessions in during the week, get stronger, maintain muscle mass, but can't handle doing it all through via CrossFit. That's where you could take somebody like that and experiment with, say, like, you know, 2 WODs a week combined with 2 super slow training sessions per week in a low impact manner.
Yeah. Joel Jameson, he kind of recommends that for a lot of fighters too.
Yeah.
And he's tracking HRV a lot too, and he kind of is a bigger fan of the tempo stuff, I think.
Yeah, I wish more people would get into, and I talked about this a little bit in my talk the other day, I wish more people would get into the water too, because you can combine cold thermogenesis, hypoxia, and then low impact training, and you can get a ton of benefit in the water with something like that. I mean, like I was out in Barton Springs pool this morning, and so that was, I think it was probably about 55, 60 degrees in that pool. So cold enough for some cold thermogenesis.
That is cold enough.
Shutting down some inflammatory cytokines. You know, I was in there for about 30 minutes. I did a lot of hypoxic sets, which means you're swimming underwater. You don't have to be Michael Phelps to swim underwater. But you just do about 10 sets where you're going as long as you can on one breath.
Mm-hmm.
So that hypoxic training has a really good growth hormone boosting effect. The cold thermogenesis is really good for shutting down inflammation. And then, of course, you're also just getting the low impact movement. So I think more people
exercising
should tap into water
and healing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm a big fan of water. I'm building a house right now up in Washington, and I've kind of got like my own little man cave next to the house, and I'm putting basically like a little cold pool in there that's got one of those. It's like an endless pool where you can mm-hmm. swim, but I'll be able to get in there and do hypoxic sets, get the cold thermogenesis, and for me it's important enough where I'm actually, you know, investing in one of those for my house versus like, you know, I don't buy a nice treadmill or something like that. So,
wow.
One of the other interesting chapters I saw in your book was the 21 ways to hack your brain.
Mm.
Maybe touch on just a few of those. Like, what are your favorite brain hacks?
Yeah, I guess we could talk about like stacks. So, you
know, nootropics.
Yeah, nootropics are things that you want to start off a day with. There's probably let's do three. I'm a big fan of Chinese adaptogenic herbs. There are blends out there, and you know, you're looking at things like Eleuthero, Ashwagandha, Rhodiola, Vinpocetine, Huperzine A, or Club Moss derivative, and you've got companies, you know, like Onnit putting a lot of these things into their brain supplements. I use one called TNChi, which is just like a powdered adaptogen that I'll dump into a glass of water kind of mid-morning on an empty stomach. I like those because you get a combination of improving cerebral vascular flow. You get some neuronal effect from some of the neurotropics in there, like Huperzine, but then you also get the restorative adrenal effect when you use something like that. So for an athlete,
mm-hmm.
you're killing two birds with one stone. So you're helping to produce more cortisol if cortisol is too low, less if it's too high, and then mm-hmm. getting the neurotropic effect. Another one I really like is combining caffeine and L-theanine, especially for like afternoon doses of caffeine, because L-theanine helps to balance out some of the anti-sleep effects that caffeine can have. And mm-hmm. something that I've been combining that with in the morning is creatine, just mm-hmm. about 5 grams of creatine, which is a nice nootropic, but also obviously has some really good research proven performance enhancing effects.
Mm-hmm.
And then a stack, like if you just really, I mean, if you've got a day, you know, like maybe PaleoFX, where you're just like going all day, never stopping. Piracetam, aniracetam, and alpha GPC is a pretty good combo. So you can go to a website like Peak Nootropics and get the stuff bulk. Usually a 2-to-1 ratio of piracetam to aniracetam, and then you throw in about 500 milligrams of alpha GPC because you'll turn over choline in your brain super duper fast once you start into piracetam aniracetam.
You have to supplement with choline.
You could use
aniracetam.
Yeah, an alpha GPC is a choline derivative. So you could use walnuts or krill oil or something like that, but about 500 milligrams of alpha GPC works really well. And you can literally just like dump all that onto a digital spoon, dump it in your mouth, hold it for 90 seconds, chase it with a glass of water, and you'll be rolling strong for about 12 hours or so.
So if you're a CrossFitter and you're eating, you know, 3 to 6 eggs every day, you get enough choline from egg yolks.
Yeah, you're gonna get a pretty decent dose of choline from that. And you know, I've tried this with walnuts, I've tried it with eggs, I've tried it with krill oil, you know, for a phosphatidylcholine source. Alpha GPC is expensive, but you do notice a difference once you use that stuff versus like a food-based source of choline. So
when you say a difference, that's kind of an abstract term. What does that mean?
It lasts longer. And I suspect it's because the choline from food sources is simply, you know, it's like, you know, an apple has whatever, 15 milligrams of vitamin C, and you could also, you know, get 5 grams or 5,000 milligrams from a, you know, Whole Foods vitamin C source. So it's just dumping a concentrated form of choline into your body. I suspect that's where the difference is. There might be some bioavailability differences between, you know, alpha GPC and choline from eggs, but I'm not sure about that.
I forget who I was talking to. I was talking to somebody that was pretty knowledgeable on it, and they said that the eggs just weren't going to cut it. You have to almost supplement if you're going to use an aniracetam.
Yeah.
That's all hearsay.
I mean,
that's
like I've tried the whole food stuff. Like I have tried handfuls of walnuts and eggs, and I've tried, you know, the krill oil, and I mean that the alpha GPC works pretty well. That tea and chi stuff I talked about, the Chinese adaptogenic herb blend, that has something called cytocholine in it, which is a different form of the choline molecule. And cytocholine, if you can find something that has that, and it works pretty well too.
Yeah.
In addition to something like alpha GPC.
Cool. Let's take a break real quick. When we come back, we can talk about performance supplements too.
This is Andrea Ager, and you're listening to Barbell Shrug. For the video version, go to barbellshrug.com.
Barbell Shrug is brought to you by you. To learn more about how you can support the show, go to barbellshrug.com and sign up for the newsletter.
And we're back with Ben Greenfield. We just finished up talking, or kind of went over a few things for mental performance supplementation. What do you do for your physical performance supplementation?
For physical performance, it depends on the day. So, you know, I do a lot, especially for endurance performance, with ketosis, which means that you are trying to drive primarily fatty acids through your Krebs cycle and producing ketones as a byproduct of that. And the cool thing is that ketones are a preferred form of fuel for the heart, for the diaphragm. So you're using a lot of these endurance-based muscles and giving them the fuel that they want. And it's also a very, very stable source of fuel for the brain. So there's a little bit of a mental acuity and mental focus enhancing effect for something like that. The issue with doing that, though, is a lot of times when you are generating ATP through the oxidation of fats, you generate ATP at a little bit slower rate than you would if you were oxidizing carbs or glucose. So this is where micronutrients and smart supplementation can come in handy to give you a little bit of an advantage from that respect. One thing you should do is consider restoring either the precursors for ATP or else ATP itself, so that you're generating ATP exogenously at a more rapid rate. I'm a fan, if you're going to do like a low carb, high intensity type of session for something like that, of a D-ribose, which works really, really well as an ATP precursor. And then you can also use something like disodium ATP, which you can buy in supplemental form and use that prior to a high intensity, low carb, or high intensity fasted workout. A couple of other things that work really well in conjunction with that is about 5 to 10 grams of amino acids to stave off central nervous system fatigue. And branched chain amino acids like leucine and isoleucine and valine, those are going to feed directly into the Krebs cycle and actually be a decent source of energy, whereas some of the other essential amino acids that you would get from an essential amino acid supplement, not a branched chain amino acid supplement, but basically it'd be an EAA versus a BCAA type of supplement. Those are going to help a little bit more with staving off breakdown of skeletal muscle tissue during like a fasted or a low carb type of workout session. So amino acids, D-ribose, disodium ATP, Caffeine can help a little bit with mobilization of fatty acid stores. So something like a green tea or a caffeine source can be helpful. And those are a few of the things that work pretty well for something like endurance. I guess the last thing would just be straight up MCTs, like using an MCT oil.
Yeah.
Caprylic acid is another good source of MCTs. Coconut oil is a less expensive source of MCTs. But the reason I say MCTs is because those are driven past digestion and into the muscle for use as a tissue pretty favorably if carbohydrates are absent. If carbohydrates aren't absent, that won't happen. You know, if you do whatever, bulletproof coffee with a scone, you're pretty much negating all the effects of like a bulletproof coffee.
I tried to get some folks a while back. These were not fitness oriented people.
Yeah.
And I was introducing them to bulletproof coffee and they started pouring sugar.
Yeah.
In theirs. I was like, you're ruining it. Like the whole idea is that you'd have just that.
Yeah.
And then they were like, no, but it tastes better this way. I'm like,
yeah.
No, I tried to explain the benefits of like not having the sugar, and it didn't go over too well.
The presence of exogenous carbohydrates completely negates the entry of MCTs into that Krebs cycle. So you shove it down the hatch. So that would be for endurance, but there's strength stuff too. You know, I'm a big fan of beta alanine, L-carnitine. Like I mentioned, just a straight up 5 grams of creatine on a daily basis. There's another one that kind of flies under the radar called oxaloacetate, which upregulates the conversion of lactic acid into glucose in the liver via something called the Cori cycle.
Oh, wow.
And so that actually works well also if you're going to do
What's
a high intensity interval training session in a fasted or a low carb state, but it works well for performance hacking as well. That's called oxaloacetates.
Okay.
An example of something that you'd find that in would be, you know, we just talked about bulletproof coffee and not to kiss up to Dave Asprey too much, but like he's got a upgraded anti-aging, I think it's called anti-aging product, and that's got oxaloacetate in it, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also get it in supplemental form, you know, from Amazon.
Is that part of his glutathione type? Mm-mm. Or something different?
No, it's different than glutathione. So
it's not, I was wondering if maybe he put that ingredient in this glutathione product. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it's not in there.
Something separate.
I don't know if there would be any absorptibility issues if you mixed oxaloacetate with glutathione, but it's not in combination in any of his products that I know of. So
the oxaloacetate helps convert lactate back into glucose. So
exactly.
It basically helps, kind of like beta alanine, it helps decrease muscular acidity so you can keep training harder for longer.
Yeah, more or less. Mm-hmm. It's not going to speed up buffering of lactic acid per se, but if you're buffering lactic acid well, which is why combining this with something like beta alanine is a good idea, then what you're going to do is take that lactic acid and convert it back into glucose. So
I haven't seen any studies on that, but I've never looked. Do you know any studies on that you could cite that you know, like specifically what they use or how much they use?
Not the titles of the study, but basically it has to do with restoration of NADH. And so what you'd want to do is use a search term like oxaloacetate, NADH on PubMed, and you'd be able to find some of the stuff. This originally was something that was used as an anti-aging kind of hack out of the Silicon Valley Longevity Institute, anti-aging folks over there. I found out about it over at Dave Asprey's Bulletproof Conference.
Mm-hmm.
Started using it in athletes, and then came across some good research showing its conversion. So
it sounds like you're a proponent of like a ketogenic diet for endurance athletes. What about guys like?
Yeah, I mean, like, let's put it this way: if you're pretty serious and you want to like hack endurance to the max, yeah. But I mean, like, it's tough socially to pull off something like that too. For mental biohacking, it also works really, really well. And you know, this came up yesterday in our ketosis panel here at PaleoFX. There may be some elevation of adrenaline during a high intensity interval training and something like CrossFit as well, if you're in a state of ketosis, but man, there are so many things you got to be careful with. Everything from thyroid dysregulation to, low levels of blood glucose. So you get an absence of glycoprotein formation and your joints go to crap. I mean, like, there's a lot of stuff you got to be careful with.
So would you recommend a ketogenic diet to someone who's training 2 to 3 hours a day, CrossFit style type training? People who are training for competition? So we get a lot of people that are training high volume, trying to follow a paleo style ketogenic diet, and
if you want every advantage possible and you're willing to eat a lot of organ meats, probably use something like a thyroid glandular If you are going to be using some of the things I talked about, like MCT oils, D-ribose, disodium ATP, amino acids, you're willing to not go cyclic, which is going to throw you out of a lot of the benefits of fatty acid oxidation.
So not that you can't have your cheat day on the weekend.
And you're willing to stick with it for at least over 6 months. So you're getting a pretty big upregulation of mitochondrial biogenesis. So you're actually churning out enough ATP from fatty acid oxidation. The answer is yes. The problem is most people aren't willing to kind of biohack to that extent.
That takes a commitment. So most
it
people,
does, but
most
I mean,
people probably shouldn't.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're super serious and you want to do it, then go for it. But if you're just going to dabble with it, it's not worth it.
Yeah. So 6 month commitment. No real cheat meals in there.
Yeah.
You gotta.
Well, I mean, you could have a cheat meal, but it could be like freaking, you know, coconut ice cream.
But not like pizza. But not like twice a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
Once every 2 weeks or something?
It depends. I mean, you can mix like, you know, caprylic acid and coconut milk and dark chocolate powder and some cinnamon and some stevia. I mean, you can make good stuff and be in ketosis, but you got to be careful when you walk into an Italian restaurant. So
yeah, most people aren't going to be able to pull that off.
Yeah.
So if...
Especially here at PaleoFX with all our paleo cookies.
That's right.
They're everywhere and they're delicious.
Those cavemen, man, they made some killer cookies back in the day. But
so... Go ahead. I was gonna say you have another section of your book where you talk about lifestyle, and I like all the title chapters in your book. They're very good headlines, and they're all very catchy. And you had one in there about like the hidden killers in your home or something like that. Like I know you got to go here pretty quick. Give us like your favorite killer in your home, whatever the hell that means.
My favorite killer, or my least favorite killer. I mean, my home's kind of biohacked to decrease a lot of things like EMF, molds, toxins, things of that nature. You know, we use all organic cleaning chemicals and personal care products, stuff like that. One of the things that we have in every outlet of our home is a dirty electricity filter to filter off electrical pollution, just because of electrical surges that can happen as power kind of travels back to the substations.
I know you said in your talk, you were talking about people having laptops on their, around their lap. They have like protective padding between your laptop and your,
exactly.
Your nice area.
I can't have kids.
I use something called I use a HeraPad for that. But the problem is like, I don't use that much cause I don't usually sit down with my laptop in my lap. But like if I'm at a conference and I have to be sitting there with my laptop taking notes or something, that's what I have out. But when I'm at my standing workstation working, I ground my laptop. You can like go to lessemf.com and you can get a grounding cable. It's a USB cable. You plug that in, the other end goes into the grounding outlet.
So
through the dirty electricity filter. That's not the one I would get rid of first. But standing here looking at the huge Austin skyline, just electricity came to mind. But yeah, I mean, like that's a pretty good one. And then if you live in an urban area, a HEPA air filter with a negative ion generator is a pretty good pick. So,
and what's the benefit of that?
The benefit of that is that you're mitigating the effect of a lot of the positive ions that are going to be emitted from a high level of electricity in the home or the office, and then you're also decreasing a lot of like mold exposure, cleaning chemicals, stuff like that are floating around in the air. So you kind of kill two birds with one stone with something like a HEPA air filter with a negative ion generator.
Are you part of like the new, maybe it's not that new, but like the no poo movement? Nobody's using shampoo anymore or putting chemicals on their bodies. It seems to be building right now.
I use soap about once every 2 days. So I'm mostly a water guy, and then I use Dr. Bronner's. Usually I'll use something like coconut oil as an antiperspirant, so I'm pretty basic when it comes to that stuff. I'm married, but I still get laid. So, don't think I'm too stinky. Yeah, even though she has to. She has the choice.
Well, cool. Where can people find more information about you?
Yeah, I got a blog at bengreenfieldfitness.com. Published, you know, like lots of stuff. Tomorrow's article is on... a bunch of alternatives to spending $9 on Viagra if you still want to get big in the bedroom. And then
everyone will be going to that one.
That's right.
And then my new book that we kind of talked about just now is at beyondtrainingbook.com.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us.
Cool.
Yeah,
thanks,
appreciate
for having me on, guys.
You bet.
All right, guys, make sure to go to barbellshrug.com, sign up for the newsletter, and we'll notify you whenever we post one of these awesome podcasts.